So, picture Tiger Woods for a second, right? He basically had a golf club in his hands before he could even, like, walk.
Yeah, literally a toddler with a putter.
Exactly. His whole entire childhood was just completely engineered around this one highly specific mechanics of hitting a golf ball. I mean, he is pretty much the ultimate extreme early
Oh,
specialist.
without a doubt.
But then you look at someone like Roger Federer
Yeah.
and his mother, who I think was actually a tennis coach herself.
She was, yeah.
Right, so she actively prevented him from committing to tennis too early on. Like, she intentionally kept him sampling this massive variety of sports.
Yeah, he's doing wrestling, skiing, swimming, playing basketball, you name it.
Right, so he was the ultimate generalist during all those developmental years. And yet, both of these athletes achieved this undeniable, greatest of all time status in their respective arenas.
They did.
But they took completely wildly opposite paths to get there. So how is that mathematically possible?
I mean, it seems like a paradox, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But comparing Woods and Federer isn't actually a contradiction at all.
No.
No, it's basically a category error because long before they ever stepped onto a course or a court, they were actually playing two fundamentally different kinds of games.
Okay, wow.
Yeah. And so for today's deep dive, we are really decoding that ultimate career dilemma. Should you build your careers as a generalist or a specialist?
And more importantly, for everyone listening, we want to help you figure out which game you are actually playing in your own life right now.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because I feel like the most intuitive path to success, like the one we are all basically taught from childhood, is specialization.
Pick a lane and stick to it.
Exactly. You pick a lane, you put your head down, and you become this undisputed expert. Let's look at the medical field, like specifically surgery, because it illustrates the raw power of depth so perfectly.
Oh, it really does.
If you are going in for a super complex procedure, you definitely don't want a surgeon who, like, dabbles, let's
Right,
say.
definitely not. You want the surgeon who has performed that exact specific maneuver 10,000 times. And the data on this is completely unequivocal.
Yeah, surgeons who do the exact same procedure repeatedly have measurably lower complication rates.
Way lower than the ones with broader, more varied caseloads.
Right, and the mechanism behind that is just fascinating to me. In high-stakes work, depth isn't just, a nice bullet point on a resume. It's basically the entire difference between being competent and being outright dangerous.
That makes total sense.
When a surgeon repeats that specific procedure, they are building this really profound muscle memory. But even more crucially, they're undergoing a process of neural pruning.
Wait, neural pruning.
Yeah, so their brain literally wires itself to recognize the specific texture of the tissue they're working with. It anticipates the exact type of bleeding that might occur in that one specific millimeter of anatomy.
Oh, wow. So it's practically subconscious at that point.
Precisely. They don't have to consciously think about the mechanics anymore. Their brain has completely automated the routine, so their conscious mind can focus entirely on just executing flawlessly.
Which brings up the actual science of expertise. Because, you always hear people throw around that 10,000 hours rule from pop
Is that
culture.
right, the Malcolm Gladwell thing?
Yeah, exactly. As if just simply showing up and doing something for a decade automatically makes you a master. But Anders Ericsson, the cognitive psychologist who actually pioneered the research on expertise, he found something very different.
Very different.
His concept of deliberate practice is honestly wildly misunderstood by most people.
It really is. I mean, Erickson's research absolutely did not show that just general effort leads to mastery. The true engine of expertise is narrow, structured, highly uncomfortable repetition in a specific skill.
Uncomfortable being the key word there.
Exactly. Think about chess grandmasters or concert violinists. They aren't just broadly exposing themselves to board games or casually putting on classical music while they cook. They're doing thousands of hours of highly focused drills on one very narrow craft. And the key variable in all of this, fast, perfectly clear feedback.
So they know immediately if they messed up.
Exactly. They make a move, they instantly see why it failed, and they course correct on the very next attempt.
Wow.
That super tight feedback loop is what actually builds a master.
And there is a massive economic reality tied to this too, right? Like if you go all the way back to Adam Smith and the division of labor, the market fundamentally rewards the person who can do one valuable thing better than anyone else.
Absolutely.
If you're just a decent generalist, if you're a little bit good at marketing, a little bit good at coding, maybe some design, you don't really have anything distinctive to offer.
They blend in.
Right. In pure economic terms, the generalist, without a spike in any one skill, just becomes a commodity. They are easily replaceable. But the specialist,
yeah.
The specialist has a moat.
And that moat is exactly what gives you leverage. When you're the absolute best at a specific, really difficult task, you get to dictate the terms.
Which entirely flips that tired cliche of follow your passion on its head.
Oh, totally.
Cal Newport has this brilliant concept of career capital. You know, the cultural narrative tells you to just follow your passion and hope the money and respect magically follow you.
Which rarely works out.
Right. But Newport argues that autonomy, you know, the ability to do interesting work on your own terms, which is what we all actually want anyway, is something you have to buy.
And you need currency for that.
Exactly. And the currency you use to buy it is career capital. You earn that capital by becoming incredibly good at a specific, rare, and valuable skill. Passion is the result of mastery, not the prerequisite for it.
That's such a crucial shift in perspective. Hey. And in modern economics, the rewards for that mastery are completely disproportionate.
What do you mean?
Well, we are operating in winner-take-most markets now. Think about tech, finance, media, or, you know, that top tier of specialized medicine we just talked about.
Okay, yeah.
The absolute best narrow specialist doesn't just earn double what the 10th best person makes. Because of digital distribution and global networks, attention and hiring get concentrated so brutally at the very top.
Right. Everybody wants the best.
Right. So that number one specialist might earn 10 times or even 50 times more. Power law economics basically dictate that the premium for being in the top 1% of a narrow field is astronomical.
But there is no comparable premium for being, like, solidly above average at six different things.
Exactly. Depth compounds over time.
Okay, so as I'm thinking about this, it sounds like being a specialist is kind of like building this impenetrable fortress. You know, you dig a massive moat, you build incredibly high reinforced walls.
Right, you stockpile your weapons.
Yeah, you are completely secure, basically dominating the landscape. And here is where I get hung up. Doesn't a fortress only work if the enemy actually attacks exactly where you built the walls?
Oh, that is the pivotal question right there.
Because what happens to that incredibly specialized software engineer? The person who built an absolute fortress of knowledge around one specific coding language when the entire industry shifts to a new language overnight?
It completely exposes the hidden, incredibly fragile assumption underneath the whole specialist path. Like you said, a fortress is a brilliant strategy if the battlefield is static.
If the landscape never changes, you want the highest walls.
Exactly. But when the rules of the battlefield change overnight, that heavily fortified fortress suddenly becomes a tomb. You're trapped inside the very walls you built to protect yourself.
Oh, man.
And this is exactly why breadth becomes absolutely essential when predictability vanishes.
So if a static battlefield rewards the fortress, how do we know if the battlefield we are currently on is going to change?
Well, the researcher David Epstein offers this fantastic mental model for this that really clarifies everything. He divides the world into two fundamentally different types of learning environments.
Okay.
He calls them kind environments and wicked environments.
Okay. Kind and wicked. Let's break those down. What's a kind environment?
So a kind environment is basically generous to the learner. The rules are stable, the boundaries are super clear, and the feedback is immediate and highly accurate.
Like chess.
Exactly. Chess is a kind environment. The board is always 8x8. The knight always moves in an L shape. Golf is another kind environment.
Right. The ball is literally stationary.
And you get immediate visual feedback on exactly where it lands. Classical music, standardized surgery, these are all kind. You practice the same narrow thing, you get incrementally better, and the world does not just move under your feet.
So in a kind environment, the early, deep specialist wins every single time. That is Tiger Woods' domain.
Exactly.
So a kind environment is basically a game where the rules were written in stone like 100 years ago. But a wicked environment, let me guess, a wicked environment is like trying to play chess while the board is on fire, half the pieces are missing, and the rules change every three turns.
That is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
A wicked environment does not play fair at all. The rules shift constantly.
And the feedback.
The feedback you get is delayed, it's ambiguous, or sometimes it's actively misleading.
Yeah.
Like, you might make the perfect strategic decision in a business context, but then you lose millions of dollars just because of some macroeconomic shift you couldn't control.
Wow. Yeah.
This is the realm of entrepreneurship, complex strategy, and honestly, almost all modern knowledge work. Anything touched by rapid technological disruption is, by definition, a wicked environment.
And in a wicked environment, deep, narrow practice can actually be a liability, right? Like it can actively make you worse.
Yes, because if you hyper-specialize in a wicked domain, you become incredibly, astonishingly elite at solving yesterday's version of the problem.
Oh, that's a dangerous trap.
Very. When the problem changes, your rigid mental models just fail. Epstein's research shows that across a huge range of wicked fields, the people who actually end up dominating are what he calls the late specializers.
Late specializers.
Yeah, these are people who sampled broadly, they tried different fields, they failed, they experimented long before finally picking a lane.
But why do they outperform the people who got a huge head start?
It really comes down to cognitive psychology and analogical thinking. A specialist has one mental model. If a problem doesn't fit that model, they're just stuck.
Right.
But a generalist who has sampled widely, they have a really diverse toolkit of mental models.
So they can adapt.
Exactly. When a completely novel, unprecedented problem appears in a wicked environment, the generalist is the one who can say, wait, this problem in marketing actually looks exactly like a structural engineering problem I studied 5 years ago.
So they can connect dots across disciplines that the specialist didn't even know existed.
They break rigid thinking.
Okay, so if the environment is constantly punishing narrow experts, the only defense mechanism is combining diverse non-elite skills to sort of survive the chaos.
Right.
The creator of the Dilbert comic strip, Scott Adams, he has a fascinating, highly pragmatic way of looking at this. He calls it the talent stack.
I love the talent stack.
Yeah, the premise is that trying to be in the top 1% of the world in one specific thing is brutally hard. I mean, it requires a terrifying amount of sacrifice and, honestly, a lot of genetic luck.
Oh, definitely.
So instead of playing that lottery, you combine several different skills where you only really need to be in the top 25%.
It is such an incredibly liberating mathematical equation. You don't have to be a world-class genius at anything. You just need to be solidly above average, like top quartile, but in a combination that almost nobody else possesses.
Right. Adams famously pointed out that he wasn't the greatest artist in the world.
No, definitely not.
And he wasn't the funniest joke writer in the world either, and he definitely wasn't the sharpest business mind. But his stack was completely unique.
Because of the combination.
Yes, he was a top 25% cartoonist, plus a top 25% observer of corporate culture, plus a top 25% self-promoter. That specific intersection created something highly lucrative and incredibly rare.
The stack itself basically becomes the moat.
Exactly. If I look at my own talent stack, I mean, I might be in the top 25% of, you know, deep dive hosts, but I'm also in the top 25% of people who stress eat while looking at LinkedIn. It's a very specific niche market I've cornered.
Well, I think we can all relate to the LinkedIn stress eating, to be honest.
It's rough out there.
It is. But on a serious note, this breadth isn't just some quirky strategy for artists and entrepreneurs. It is the absolute core of what we call the leadership inflection in corporate careers.
The leadership inflection.
Yeah, think about the standard career trajectory. The skill that gets a person promoted early on as an individual contributor is almost always depth.
Right. You get promoted because you're the most rigorous data analyst or the fastest coder.
Exactly. But mid-career transitions demand an entirely different toolkit.
Because suddenly you aren't doing the specialized work anymore. You are managing the people doing the work.
Precisely. To integrate cross-functional teams, to, you know, translate between the engineering department and the marketing department, and to make high-stakes decisions with totally incomplete information, you must be a generalist.
Which explains so much.
Right. This is why so many brilliant specialists fail completely spectacularly when they're promoted to management.
Because they spent 15 years optimizing for depth.
Exactly. Applying rigid rules to static problems. And suddenly, they hit a role that demands high emotional intelligence, adaptability, and breadth. Depth compounds inside a stable game. But the moment the game changes, like moving into leadership breadth, is what lets you survive.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because I have to push back a little on this whole talent stack philosophy.
Okay, let's hear it.
It sounds wonderful in theory, but let's be honest with ourselves. Isn't a stack of 5 above average skills often just mediocrity with better branding?
That's a fair question.
Like, how do we ensure that championing breadth doesn't just become this convenient permission slip for endless dabbling? You know, someone never actually commits to the grueling, boring work of mastery. And when they fail, they just shrug and say, oh, I'm not failing. I'm just building my talent stack.
That is the exact tension we have to confront here.
Yeah.
Both philosophies have massive blind spots. But to defend the talent stack first, A true talent stack is not made of mediocre skills.
Okay.
Top 25% still requires years of rigorous, dedicated work. It is an achievable bar, but it is not an easy one.
So it's not a free pass?
No, not at all. It trades the near impossible genetic lottery of the top 1% for a realistic but demanding standard across multiple disciplines. If your skills are actually mediocre, say, top 60%, the combination is entirely worthless. The market won't pay for a stack of mediocrity.
Fair enough. But the dabbling is still a real danger, I think. Generalists have a very loud failure mode here.
What do you mean by loud?
Well, a generalist might dip their toes into a new field, hit the dip where learning gets genuinely difficult and noisy, and immediately write it off.
Oh, right.
They tell themselves, oh, this is a wicked environment, the rules are too messy, I should just move on. But in reality, it might just be a kind environment with a really steep learning curve.
They give up too soon.
Exactly. Because they don't stick around long enough to suffer through the friction, they never decode the underlying deep structure that a specialist would eventually master. They fail to achieve true competence because they use breath as an excuse for a total lack of grit.
It is a totally valid critique. But we have to recognize that the specialist has a failure mode that is just as dangerous. It just flies under the radar.
A quiet failure mode.
Yeah, let's bring back the surgeon example. That hyper-specialized surgeon we praised earlier.
Right, the one with perfect stats.
Exactly. They have absolutely perfect statistics for their one specific procedure. But because their pattern recognition is so incredibly narrow, because their brain has literally pruned away the ability to see outside their focus area, they are the single most likely person to completely miss an adjacent unexpected problem.
Oh, wow.
We call this inattentional blindness. If they open a patient up for a routine appendix removal and there is a massive life-threatening abnormality on the liver right next to it, their brain might literally filter it out.
Just because it doesn't fit their template.
Exactly. Because it doesn't fit their exact mental template for an appendix surgery.
Mm-hmm.
They are literally blind to the edge cases.
Wow. Okay, so both paths have these symmetric failures. Generalists fail loudly. You know, they bounce around. Their resumes look completely chaotic. They never achieve real competence. And it's super obvious to everyone, including themselves.
Right.
But specialists fail quietly. They fail on the edge cases. They never even recognize we're there in the first place. They're completely competent right up until the exact moment they're catastrophically obsolete.
Exactly. Neither path is completely safe. The fantasy of the perfect career strategy just doesn't exist. Which means we can't just debate the theory forever.
We have to figure out how to actually apply this to the messy reality of a human life.
Precisely.
Which brings us to the most crucial part of this discussion. We've seen the pros and cons. We understand the mechanisms. So what does this all mean for you?
The listener.
Yeah. How do you, the listener, figure out your own path right now? There is a really practical 3-question framework derived from all this research that cuts through the noise to help you evaluate your own career trajectory. Let's walk through it.
Okay. So question one is environmental. Is your field kind or wicked? You have to honestly look at the structural reality of your industry.
Right.
If you are in a domain with stable rules, clear boundaries, fast feedback, and a very low rate of technological disruption.
Like classical music or standard accounting.
Exactly. Or certain highly standardized types of law that is a massive structural vote for depth. Go deep. Build the fortress.
But if it's not stable.
If your field is volatile. If client demands change weekly, if feedback is ambiguous, or if your core tools are being entirely reshaped by software every 2 years, you absolutely must actively cultivate breath.
Makes sense. So question two is chronological. Where are you in your career arc? Because careers are not linear. They don't just go in a straight line from novice to expert.
No, they really don't.
Early on, especially in your 20s or your first decade in the workforce, is naturally a sampling period. Even people who end up as these elite specialists usually explore multiple directions early on, so their eventual commitment is informed by actual experience, not just a guess.
Right. You have to sample first.
And then as you hit mid-career, you move into a phase of compounding depth.
That is where you build the moat. You find the intersection of what you are good at and what the market actually values, and you drill down.
But you can't stay there forever.
No. You have to be prepared for the second inflection point later on. If you want to move into leadership, strategy, or entrepreneurship, the requirement flips back to breadth.
So the sequence isn't just depth, then breadth.
No, it is sampling broadly, then compounding depth to build capital, and then leveraging that capital into breadth at a higher altitude of leadership.
Which is such a clear roadmap. And then there is Question three, which I think is honestly the most empathetic and overlooked factor in this entire debate. What is your actual personality?
Yes, this is so important.
Not your ambition, not what your parents want for you, not what sounds cool on a deep dive, but how are you intrinsically, neurologically wired?
This is where we really have to be honest with ourselves.
Yeah.
Some people naturally possess high conscientiousness. They are patient. They are super comfortable with routine and delayed gratification.
They like knowing what to expect.
Exactly. They have low novelty-seeking tendencies.
Yeah.
Think about how you feel on a Sunday night. If the idea of waking up on Monday to refine the exact same complex task you were working on Friday brings you this deep sense of comfort and satisfaction, you might be a natural specialist.
Those people are genuinely energized by incremental mastery.
They are.
But other people are completely the opposite.
Oh, absolutely.
They are high in trait openness. If they have to do the exact same task for a month, they want to pull their hair out.
They get bored easily.
So easily. The moment a skill stops producing brand new, chaotic problems to solve, they're done. They thrive at the messy intersections of different fields, connecting dots that others miss. They are natural generalists.
And the real danger here is forcing a fit that goes against your fundamental nature.
Yeah.
Forcing a natural generalist, someone who intensely craves novelty, to pick a lane and go incredibly deep for a decade, doesn't build them a protective moat.
It just builds a well-defended cell.
Exactly. They will feel completely suffocated and trapped. Conversely, forcing a natural specialist who loves deep, focused work into this broad, chaotic management role where they just have to put out interpersonal fires all day,
they'll hate it.
It will just make them miserable. And frankly, a mediocre manager.
So what if you, the listener, are sitting there right now, maybe commuting or walking the dog, and you genuinely don't know the answer to these questions yet?
That's a scary feeling.
It is. What if you look at your industry and you just can't tell if it's kind or wicked? What if you look inward and you really aren't sure what your true personality leans toward? It can feel incredibly anxiety-inducing to feel like you just don't have a strategy.
It is totally normal to feel that anxiety. But if you don't know the answers yet, it simply means you are still in a sampling phase.
And that's okay.
It's perfectly fine. The correct strategic move is to keep sampling, but to do it on purpose. Treat exploration as an active, aggressive strategy, not just some passive default where you drift from job to job.
Like, be intentional about it.
Exactly. Keep a journal of what energizes you and what drains you.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is the absolute key to making it work, you have to set a strict, non-negotiable deadline for yourself to make a choice and commit to a period of depth.
Because if you don't set a deadline, you just end up drifting forever. You avoid the hard work of mastery and you try to dress up your indecision by calling it flexibility.
Precisely. Flexibility without a timeline is really just procrastination.
So to wrap this all up, the big takeaway here is that asking, should I be a generalist or a specialist, was basically always the wrong question.
It's the total false dichotomy.
The real question is figuring out which one you are building on purpose for the specific game you are actually in right now, while also respecting your own psychological wiring.
Exactly.
But before we sign off, there is one final, pretty provocative thought that emerges from all this data that I want to leave you with. Something to really mull over as you look at the future of your own industry over the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay, what is it?
Well, we established that kind environments, games with stable rules and clear feedback reward specialists, right?
Right.
But as artificial intelligence rapidly advances, look at what it is actually automating first. It is automating the kind environments.
Oh, wow. It is a staggering realization when you really look at the mechanisms of machine learning. AI trains on massive data sets with very clear right and wrong answers.
Right. AI is mastering the stable rules, it's mastering coding syntax, it's mastering standard financial data analysis, basic medical diagnostics, routine legal document review.
All the stuff we thought required deep human specialization.
Exactly. Anything that requires recognizing a static pattern is basically being handed over to the algorithm. Mm-hmm. So if AI can automate anything with stable rules and clear feedback, is it possible that technology is literally turning every stable field into a wicked one?
I mean, it's highly probable. If the baseline rules of your specialty are constantly shifting because technology is eating the foundational tasks, the very definition of what it means to be a modern specialist is going to radically change.
It has to.
It might eventually require a mandatory, massive foundation of generalist adaptability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ability to connect dots across disciplines, manage ambiguity, and ask truly novel questions just to survive the technological shifts.
The specialist of the future might just be a generalist in disguise.
That is a fascinating way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. It totally reframes the whole debate. So the next time you see a golfer endlessly perfecting that single identical swing in a perfectly quiet environment, or a tennis player scrambling on a clay court to return a wild, chaotic shot they've never seen before, ask yourself, which game are you training for?
Because the shape of the battlefield is ultimately up to you.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Go figure out which game you are playing today.